You're listening to All the Best Stories from Sydney on FBI.
Give me a f***ing answer! What the f*** are you doing? No! No!
Warning, bad language coming up.
Eliza Salas is my name, and on today's show, as on every show, we bring to you stories from Sydney. It's what we do here on All the Best. On today's show, no exception, of course, we will be finding out, finally, how Belvoir got its building. That piece we were meant to play to you a couple of weeks ago ran out of time, but today, I promise you, it will be on your radio. We'll also be hearing from Rosa Krell, who is an opera singer. We'll be hearing about her time in Moscow. Having a familiar friend phone in, Coffin Ed from The Naked City, the show which preceded this one in this very time slot. A great privilege to have him on, bidding a fond farewell to the Socceroos' hopes and dreams. And just a few moments, we'll be bidding another fond farewell to none other than Kevin Rudd. Right now, this is from our album of the week, it's Wolf Parade. You're tuned to All the Best here on FBI 94.5. Earlier this week, we said a historic goodbye to our then Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. Now, when we heard the news, we thought of no one better to get into the studio and bid a fond farewell to the man. Peach, formerly from Arvo's with Peach and Shag, brings us this obituary on our 26th Prime Minister.
Can I just say this? My Year 11 maths teacher wouldn't have liked Kevin Rudd. It's not because Mr. Sheen was teaching at a prestigious private school on Sydney's Lower North Shore, a school that's also the alma mater of one Anthony Abbott. It's because Mr. Rudd was a man who, among many other things, always answered questions with a question. Can I just say? I don't know, can you? Would be the predictable Mr. Sheen response. He hated bad grammar. So, may I just say this? R.I.P. Kevin Rudd. We mourn what might have been, but we also reflect on the irony that the chief asset Mr. Rudd brought to the Federal Labor Party was popularity. In hindsight, it seems a little absurd that a pompous, wordy, bookish type ended up king of the kids, and when it all came down to it, he didn't wear popularity that well. By the end, he was part dictator, part stand-up comedian. The nightmarish lives lived by his staffers, one imagines, were punctuated by clumsy one-liners. Even as he crumbled, reading a list of his achievements, he couldn't help himself. With a big slice of cheese, he paused and added, "I'm not proud of blubbering." And Kevin, by and large, we were not proud of you. The pomposity, the name-dropping, the can I just say. It tended to rub us all up the wrong way. While you did give us the moment to feel a little less unproud to be Australian on 13 February 2008, your personality managed to steadily chip away at the ground you'd gained. But despite all this, I think we all have a pang of sympathy for our 26th Prime Minister. You achieved a fair bit in 2.5 years, and you cried in your signing off speech. Look, we think you made more progress there than you ever did in the Pilbara or in Copenhagen. And Howard won elections from tougher positions, and the poll slide had stopped. But those miners, those insulators, those rat fuckers, those flight-cancelling US presidents, those Liberal premiers, those Labor premiers, those triathletes, those school principals, everyone except those voters ground you down. And now you're gone, and we feel for you, a bit. So how do we remember him? Terminally ineffectual? The most popular Labor PM ever? The least popular Labor PM ever? The victim? The tyrant? The little Prime Minister who couldn't? Well, with a nod to Mr. Sheen, may I just say all of the above, and more. And with that, I've got a zip.
Peach, formerly of Arvo's with Shag, now a full-time lawyer with that obituary on our recently departed PM. K. Rudd, rest in peace with perhaps your political career. You are listening to All the Best here on FBI. And in other big news this week, we did say a fond farewell to something else, the World Cup dreams of the Socceroos. And to celebrate, commemorate that opportunity, we'll be speaking with another of FBI's alumni, Coffin Ed from the Naked City. Hearing from him later on in the show, delivering an obituary on the Socceroos. Now, this next track, it's Jens Lekman with A Little Lost, perhaps a song Kevin Rudd wishes someone was singing to him somewhere. Nestled up the hill from Elizabeth Street, somewhere between Redfern and Central, is the Belvoir Street Theatre, which, over the years, has continued to create some of our city's most respected and challenging productions. Belvoir Street's greatly loved upstairs and downstairs stages have been the artistic watering holes of many of Australia's great performing artists, such as Geoffrey Rush, Kate Blanchett, David Wenham, Deborah Mailman, and Catherine McClements. Imagine, in place of the Belvoir Theatre, a shopping complex or an apartment block. 25 years ago, it almost happened. The man himself, Neil Armfield, told Nick Host the story of how the Belvoir got its building.
I made a ratatouille and cooked inside the ratatouille, really, kind of slow-cooked, some lamb, what's really a cut of lamb spare ribs.
When I arrived at Neil Armfield's house to find out how Belvoir Street Theatre got its building, I found him in his kitchen where he was cooking.
A bit of the, that sauce left over.
So Neil, when was Belvoir Street Theatre started?
In the 80s, a group of people, of which I was one, gathered together to raise the money to buy the theatre when it came up for sale. When the Nimrod Theatre, which had been a very important theatre in Sydney in the 70s and into the 80s, left it. And there were developers interested in buying that theatre, and so in order to save what is the kind of most perfect performing space in the country, a group of 300 or so arts practitioners and interested people that all had access to a bit of money, basically all bought shares for $1,000 each, and I was one of those people.
Was there a sense of urgency in raising this money to buy the building?
There was a very real threat that, that the space would be bought by developers and turned into retail space or more, you know, housing units. There were producers from Melbourne who were bidding against the our consortium, I know. There could have been many different outcomes. The most tragic would have been the loss of that as a theatre.
What was that building being used for before it was a theatre space?
Before that, it was a tomato sauce and condiments factory, particularly Saxa Salt, Hank, and Fountain Tomato Sauce. Before that, the same building was a workshop for Anthony Horden's, which was a great department store down the bottom of George Street through the 20th century. Uncle Kevin always said that that hill in Surrey Hills, where Belvoir Street Theatre stands, in olden times, had been pre-colonial times, had been a corroboree ground of the Gadigal people. It was a storytelling place that went back time immemorial. So it's kind of particularly appropriate that it's still a theatre.
Was it always smooth sailing, or were there times when you thought, no, this is too hard, it's not going to happen?
It was I guess what you would call a roller coaster ride. That first act of purchase, given, you know, that it had to really happen over a weekend, that money was raised, you know, it was hard, but it happened swiftly. Although there were some people who reported, yes, you can come to dinner, but not if you hit on any of my guests for money. Like, what was hard was that we had this fantastic theatre and a wonderful downstairs theatre, but nowhere apart from offices kind of crammed into the corners of the of that building for the place to be administered successfully. And we had no rehearsal room. So I did a production of Stephen Sills' great play, The Blind Giant is Dancing, in which we, you know, Hugo Weaving was the lead in that, Cate Blanchett, Gillian Jones, a company of 12. And we changed rehearsal rooms five times during a 5-week rehearsal period. It was hell. We'd be in church halls where you had to move out at 5:30 because Alcoholics Anonymous or Weight Watchers or the local Tai Chi club were coming in, depending on what particular time of day it was. Sex Addicts Anonymous was one of the groups. Fair enough. But it just wasn't successful. It wasn't fair on stage management, really. They'd have to pack up the rehearsal set every day. It was tough. The finance department upstairs couldn't stand up straight from their desk. If they stood up straight, they'd smash their heads on the slope of the ceiling, which had, of course, the raked seats above it in the auditorium. They couldn't work during the day when there are matinees because the noise of the phone ringing would go straight up through the seats into the theatre. And so we had this massive fundraising campaign in 2004, 2005, which is when we renovated the theatre. We raised $13 million, really led by the example of our chair, Louise Herron. She kind of often cajoled. It was another one of those things of come to dinner but don't ask for money, because she was so successful at it. She got money out of me. She got money out of everyone on the board.
What was her secret to getting money out of people?
Oh, I think her secret was the fact that she was obviously giving money herself, that she was... she did it with a smile. She gave you no kind of corner for manoeuvring, and she made you feel very good about giving.
Learning secrets for how to make things happen. That was Neil Armfield talking to regular All the Best contributor, Nick Hoes. You are tuned to All the Best. Stories from Sydney here on FBI 94.5. Coming up soon, we'll be hearing from Vanessa Berry, Zinester of Sydney, on Stanmore's Chocky Factory. We'll also be heading over to Russia with Rosa Krell, an opera singer, discovering about her time at the conservatorium. Right now, Poker Haunted with Make It Real here on FBI 94.5. Some of Australia's most talented, successful and inspiring women have banded together to raise some funds for and awareness of mental health. The Modern Woman's Anthology 2010 is an extraordinary literary project which brings together a unique collection of their stories, musings and memoirs. One such story comes to us from Rosa Krell, a graduated opera singer currently auditioning for Opera Australia, who recorded this piece, a section, an excerpt from her contribution to the anthology. For All the Best.
When I went to Moscow to study opera at the Conservatorium of Music, my childhood hopes and aspirations developed into feelings of overwhelming and intoxicating grandeur. The professors there had either personally known, worked with, or were students of some of the greatest composers, musicians, and artists of all time. They belonged to the last remaining generation of Russian bourgeois intelligentsia, legends of the Bolshoi Theatre and beyond. It felt as if there was one degree of separation between Shostakovich and myself, and so naturally I assumed that there would be one degree further to my impending greatness as a world-class opera diva. Moscow is a place of unfathomable paradox and polarity. Russia's popular culture is a cesspool of vulgarity, tastelessness, and outright bizarreness. It's a symbiosis of innately crude Soviet influences meshed with bastardized leftovers from the West. Yet, against this backdrop of crass pop entertainment, the traditional arts miraculously continue to flourish. Culture remains synonymous with classical music, opera, ballet, and theatre. Likewise, the Soviet system of schooling, particularly in the arts and athletics, remains notorious for its methodical and rigorous discipline and continues to produce some of the world's finest artists and sportsmen. Throughout the 1990s and towards the beginning of this century, Moscow rapidly became a hotspot for foreign business and investment, despite having barely recovered from post-perestroika insecurity and volatility. Russia's economic market developed at an astounding rate, and elements of the newly acquired free market economy permeated every aspect of contemporary life. Fortunes were swiftly made and oligarchs and media moguls surfaced on every corner. Yet for the general populace, new Russia and its future as a developing nation reeked of corruption and old-school Soviet backwardness the same way it always had. Whilst the emerging class of new Russians and wealthy foreign elite reaped the benefits of cosmopolitan living, most Russians could not afford the luxuries of supermarkets and cafes, let alone designer boutiques, snazzy restaurants, and glamorous night spots. Most Russians still shopped in dilapidated communist-era grocery shops and bazaars that now stood alongside these newly erected tokens of prosperity. Most of the working class continued to socialize around their local metro stations after work, smoking cheap cigarettes and drinking Russian vodka and Baltica beer. For all its changes, Russia remained alarmingly the same. Yet life in Moscow was exciting. It was exciting to accidentally mingle with wealthy businessmen, petty mafia, and local law enforcement, only to realize that they were ultimately all the same scum. It was exciting to get pulled over by road militia at least once a day for infringements I hadn't committed, and just as exciting to learn how to talk or bribe my way out of them. It was exciting to devise excuses on those rare occasions when I did actually commit some minor road infringement in order to avoid paying even bigger bribes. By the end of my stay in Moscow, I had been pulled over so many times that most of the road cops recognized me. They would pull me over purely to radio one another with the news that Australia, their pet name for me, was on the road again. I doubt the militia stopped bothering me because they suddenly developed a conscience. My car entered the ranks of untouchables simply because there were better cars to stop and bigger bribes to collect. It was exciting when my performances were attended by local kids from my apartment building who would gather in the courtyard to hear me practice, my bodybuilder gym buddies, my close friends from the Orthodox Jewish community, and tattoo artists who had never heard a note of classical or operatic music in their lives. This contingency of people would often infuriate the vocal faculty at the conservatorium, who already disliked me because I was a foreigner, because I was popular, because I had a good voice, and because I was a Jew. Moscow was a chaotic, hellish place that I will always love and dearly miss. It was dangerous to make money, to be a journalist, to accurately report current events, or to trust any form of law enforcement. In Russia, you cannot make decent money with an honest living, and bureaucracy and corruption will govern every decision you ever have to make. Underneath the facade of development and transformation, Russia is still a dictatorship. Yet the sky in Moscow is vast and never-ending. Someone recently told me that the horizon in Russia is actually much lower than in other parts of the world, and so the sky is higher and greater. I don't know whether this is true, or whether a lower horizon makes for a higher sky, but I would like to believe so. I used to feel as if every building and every stone in the city was a direct channel to events and people from the past, deeming them ancient, precious, and indestructible. When the Russian winter shrouded the city in snow, it became encoded with memories and terrors of another time and place. And when it became time for the light of the early summer months, the sunsets that lasted late into the night were laced with hope and melody. Mother Russia, I love you. Mother Russia, I miss you. Moscow is a place that I recount with unbearable and intolerable nostalgia. I was young when I came to Moscow, and I remember feeling very old by the time I left.
Rosa Krell with that story. You'll find it along with contributions from Kathy Freeman, Libby Hathorn, Dr. Cindy Pan, and more in the Modern Women's Anthology, which is available now. Find more info on our website, fbiradio.com. You're listening to All the Best here on that station, FBI 94.5 on your FM dial, or perhaps you're streaming over the web, which you can do, fbiradio.com, as I did just say. It's also where you can head to get the podcast of this show and previous shows on All the Best. We're podcasting each week, the full show after broadcast. You're listening to FBI. Coming up very, very soon, we will be hearing from Vanessa Berry on Stanmore's World's Finest Chocolate Store, and also Coffin Ed will be calling in to give us his rundown on the Socceroos' failed dreams. right now. This is Beirut with After the Curtain. You're on FBI 94.5. Right now, I am thrilled to bring to you something from local author Vanessa Berry. Vanessa has been writing zines for the last 15 years and is a regular contributor here on All the Best. Now, a lot of her stories are about or written around Sydney, and in 2007, she published what I reckon was one of the greatest titled local books, Strawberry Hills Forever, a tribute to her P.O. box in said suburb. Today, she brings us a story first published in I Am a Camera, number 7.
Years ago, I was walking past what was once the world's finest chocolates factory in Stanmore when I noticed that the door, which had served as the employees' entrance, hung open. I paused and looked around, overacting as if I was in a cartoon. This was my chance to explore the empty factory before its conversion to apartments. There was no one to see, so I quickly stepped through the doorway and inside. The first room I came to, which must have been the office, was decorated with fading pictures of Elvis. They were held up by yellowed sticky tape, and there were gaps where the more desirable pictures had been salvaged. I stood in the centre of this room, under the glare of multiple copies of Elvis's eyes. There was something deathly in his repeated image. I swiped one of the posters as a souvenir and crept out to explore further. Beside the main area was a storeroom through which orange light streamed in from the painted over windows. To get to it, I had climbed a flight of wooden stairs which sagged and creaked underneath my feet. At the first creak, I froze and looked around, but the noise had dissolved without alerting anyone of my trespass. A light, flighty feeling emerged in my chest. A shoplifting feeling. A shoplifting feeling. I could hear sounds of workmen from the opposite end of the building. A tinny radio, hammering, occasional yelling. I explored the gigantic room that once must have held the bulk of the machinery. It smelt stale, but still sweet, and I tiptoed among the columns, stopping when I saw the words, "I hate this place," written in texter upon one of them. The murky light and stained floor formed the perfect backdrop to this frustrated sentence. This, combined with Elvis, contributed to the sense of unease I already felt from being a trespasser. "This is a food factory. Cleanliness is essential," read a huge sign, printed in crisp black and white, in the room closest to the workmen. I could hear them on the other side of the wall, slandering one of their workmates who was having a sickie that day. Their voices barked over the omnipresent radio, and I felt triumphant that I had not been discovered. I explored until I felt I had seen all there was and slipped out again, undetected. As the apartments were being built, I became curious at how much of the original spirit of the building would be retained. I pictured apartments with door handles the shape of strawberry creams and intercom keypads like blocks of chocolate. Willy Wonka design features. When there was an open day, I went to look at the sample apartment. It resembled a hotel. There was nothing to distinguish it from any other warehouse conversion apartment here or anywhere else. Now when I walk past, I have to swerve to avoid being hit by the cigarette butts of the chocolate factory inhabitants as they fling them over their balconies. If it wasn't for the name plaques, it would be indistinguishable from all the other apartment blocks around the area. A couple of residents have hung some Chinese lanterns from their balconies, but apart from that, each segment is quite as regular as squares of the chocolate that used to be made there.
Chocolate, raspberry, lemon and lime here on FBI 94.5, a track from Muscles. Before it, we did hear something from Vanessa Berry, originally published in her I Am A Camera number 7 zine. Now, earlier in the week, of course, there was big news in politics, but also big news in sport with the Socceroos, whilst winning, I believe, against Serbia, missing out on World Cup opportunities. Now, I am totally clueless when it comes to soccer, but someone very very familiar to this time slot and to this station, Coffin Ed, I believe, is not. Coffin Ed joins me on the phone right now. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Eliza. Let me say how great it is to be back on the airwaves at FBI.
It is such a privilege to have you here. When we started this show, it was a very nerve-wracking thing to do, as well as having a massive void in my Saturday mornings. But welcome back. It's a pleasure to have you here.
It is indeed. And look, I'm very sad about the Socceroos indeed. But I've had a pretty long look at the whole thing, and I've analysed three major factors as to why we've dropped out of the World Cup. And the first of those is the Diego Maradona factor. Of course, he's the coach for Argentina, synonymous with the 1986 Hand of God at the World Cup when England were knocked out. But I think Diego Maradona set the bar for commitment that we didn't get from Pim Verbeek, our coach, our Dutch coach. Maradona said that if Argentina win the World Cup, that he was going to run naked through Buenos Aires. Now, we didn't hear any sort of inspirational talk like that from Pim. And I think if he'd said that, you know, if Australia won the World Cup, he'd run a new triathlon with Tony Abbott or something like that, that would have really lifted the team, don't you think?
I don't know. That if I were in the team, I'd be aiming to lose, so that didn't happen.
Yes, possibly. The other factor, now look, I don't mean any disrespect to John Howard. I actually thought he was dead, but I got the shock of my life when I saw him greeting the Socceroos over in South Africa, because he is the greatest mock on Australian sporting teams that has ever lived, and he should have been shut out of South Africa, because every time he's gone over to hug and greet a Australian sporting team, they've lost. And I don't know if he sees himself as some kind of Mandela-like figure as far as Australian politics go, but there he was, hugging and greeting the Socceroos with his Socceroo scarf on, his Socceroo colours. It was just the biggest mock of all time.
You think they'd have security guards to keep trash like that out, right?
Yes, indeed. And look, the third factor, and I think this is the thing that really brought Australia undone, is the Vuvuzela. Now, you're familiar with the Vuvuzela, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
The Vuvuzela is the dastardly plastic horn that the South African fans have embraced, and makes an incredible racket. It's very disturbing. It puts people off. And in that first game with Germany, where we lost 4-0, Australia wasn't Vuvuzela ready. The Germans were. The Germans had their spies over there. They knew all about the Vuvuzela, and they'd actually imported thousands of them to Germany. And prior to the German team arriving in South Africa, they actually got Kraftwerk to compose a special kind of Vuvuzela anthem, and similar to Lenny Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will, that sort of stuff. And they trained for hours and hours with that drone of Vuvuzelas in the background, and that became an inspiration for them. Whereas the Australian team, they got over there and they didn't know what was happening. They couldn't talk to each other. It just blew them apart. So put it down to the Vuvuzela.
It sounds like the Vuvuzela is almost some spiritual goddess that Germany was in tune with before playing.
Oh, definitely. They were Vuvuzela ready. If you remember, the Macquarie Dictionary's word of the year last year was shovel ready. And that's like, an infrastructure building project that's ready to go. Vuvuzela ready. We weren't Vuvuzela ready.
Some words of wisdom for this Saturday morning. Thanks so much, Coffin Ed.
Okay, look, can I just give one gratuitous plug for
please do.
A trivia night on this Wednesday? It's going to be a World Cup special. We're up at the Darlo Bar with the J-Cats and Miss Death, sort of carrying on the Naked City tradition. And anyone who's got a Vuvuzela is welcome to bring it along. It's a Darlo Bar corner of Darlinghurst Road and Liverpool Street up there from 7:30. And if you want to join in some post-World Cup mayhem, Australia being kicked out of the World Cup, I should say, come along to the Darlo Bar.
Drown your sorrows and bring your Vuvuzela.
Okay.
Thanks so much. Good luck for Wednesday.
Okay, see you, bye.
You are tuned in to All the Best. It's just about time for us to head on out of here. Kate Jinks is up next with Too Much. A couple of thank yous for today. A big thank you to Coffin Ed for coming back on the airwaves. A pleasure, as always, to have him here on FBI. Also, a big thank you to Peach, making his All the Best debut with an obituary for another loss in Australia, Kevin Rudd. Also to Nico's Neil Armfield, Rosa Krell, Vanessa Berry, and, of course, to you for tuning in. I hope you'll do it again next week, where we bring you more stories from Sydney. And, of course, if you would like to hear more All the Best, you can do so at fbiradio.com, where this show is podcast every week. That's it. Kate Jinx is up next. I'm going to leave you now with a track that I reckon a couple of Aussies will not be happy with playing, but this is dedicated to the Socceroos. It's Beck with Loser here on FBI at 94.5. All the best.
Stories from Sydney.
On FBI.